From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm David Byrd reporting. At least 27 people were killed Friday when Islamic militants stormed a hotel in Mali, West Africa. The dead include French, Canadian, Chinese, and American citizens. Malian officials say that two of the gunmen were also killed. Mariama Diallo reports that two al-Qaeda affiliates have claimed responsibility for Friday's attacks.
Malian security officials say the gunmen were jihadists who entered Bamako's Radisson Blue Hotel at 7 a.m. in a car with diplomatic plates. They took scores of hotel guests and staff hostage. State-run TV ORTM on the scene showed live pictures of Malian and French security forces who had stormed the hotel, escorting some of the hostages out. Mali has been battling rebels linked to al-Qaeda for several years. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and an affiliate, El Mourabitoun, jointly claimed responsibility for Friday's assault. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a French-sponsored resolution that calls on all able states to fight the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. The resolution calls Islamic State a global and unprecedented threat to international peace and security. The resolution asks member states that have the capacity to take all necessary measures against Islamic State and other terrorist groups. It also urges states to intensify their efforts to keep their citizens from traveling to Iraq and to Syria in order to join Islamic State. It asks that states increase efforts to prevent further attacks by the militant group, like the one last week in Paris. This is VOA News. Belgium has raised its terror alert for its capital, Brussels, to the highest level, warning of an imminent threat. The government said early Saturday that the terror alert was raised because of a very serious threat for the Brussels region. A key suspect in last week's attack in Paris, Salah Abdeslam, was last seen driving toward the Belgian border. European Union ministers agreed to tighten inspections for all travelers, including EU citizens, entering the bloc. VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
The measures are a sign of the pressure now on Europe's Schengen Protocol and the passport-free zone that for years allowed citizens of the European Union to travel unhindered throughout most of the continent. Justice and Interior ministers gathered in Brussels Friday for an emergency meeting. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve said the need for action is urgent after the attacks in his country.
Le renforcement des contrôles aux frontières extérieures.
Cazeneuve said the strengthening of external border controls, particularly in light of the heightened terrorist threat, is indispensable for the security of European citizens. Among measures to be implemented, the registering and fingerprinting of non-EU nationals who enter the Schengen area illegally. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, London.
Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard is spending his first day of freedom in more than 30 years. After he was paroled on Friday, a move welcomed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Pollard, a former U.S. Navy Investigative Service civilian analyst, was sentenced to life in prison in the mid-1980s after he pled guilty to selling classified defense documents to Israel. Mr. Netanyahu said that he welcomes Pollard's release.
As someone who raised his case before successive U.S. presidents many times, I longed for this day. And now, after three long and difficult decades, Jonathan is being released.
The 61-year-old Pollard was granted Israeli citizenship in 1995 while in prison. He is expected to settle in the New York area while he spends at least the next 5 years on parole. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, was the site of that country's prime minister denouncing the Islamic State as an evil terrorist group. At the opening of the ASEAN summit, Prime Minister Najib Razak said that the Islamic State's ideology needs to be vanquished. He spoke at the beginning of 2 days of summits that will include the leaders of Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Brunei, Thailand, and the Philippines, along with Vietnam and Laos, Myanmar and Cambodia, and U.S. President Barack Obama. For more on these stories, please log on to our website. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. A manhunt continued for terrorists who killed 129 in Paris. The suspected ringleader, a 28-year-old Belgian Moroccan, was found dead after a police raid near Paris 5 days after the initial attacks. European governments debated tightening border security, with the Dutch government even floating talk of a new passport-free zone of just 5 trusted countries, rather than the current 26-nation borderless zone. France's President François Hollande will visit Washington and Moscow for talks on how France, America and Russia might work together against the Islamic State extremist group. And in America, Republican presidential candidates demanded that Barack Obama halt plans to admit 10,000 Syrian refugees next year. Some Republicans called for a ban on admitting Muslim refugees while letting in Christians from Syria, an idea that President Obama called shameful. So it's an extremely busy, disturbing time. We've just obviously got news on Friday of this hostage crisis in Mali. Again, radical Islamists sort of fighting for control of an ex-European colony. But let's start with the lingering aftermath of those terrible attacks a week ago in Paris. Tom, what, you know, is the manhunt over, or are we reassured that it's all done and dusted, or are we still, in fact, not sure exactly how many Islamic State fighters are out there in Europe, and could they strike again?
Well, they could strike again, David. French authorities are saying that they have rolled up the cell that created the carnage in Paris, and who, according to French officials, were planning at least 2 more attacks, one in the financial district and one in Montmartre. So the notion of another imminent attack in France seems to be not so strong, but in this environment, you simply never know. But there's no question that there are terrorists in Belgium. Many of these terrorists who were captured or killed came from a suburb of Brussels, and one of the ringleaders is alleged to have slipped out of France, led into Belgium by the Belgian authorities, and still on the loose. So the bottom line is, at the moment, there seems to be a bit of stability in the French capital, but there is no question that there are more terrorists out there on the loose and could strike at any moment.
And Oren Durrell, let's discuss the role of European Union citizens in these attacks, because obviously there's been a lot of debate about, in this country, sitting in America, about Syrians coming from Syria. But in fact, the majority of the attackers, it now seems, had European passports, were traveling freely because they were EU citizens. Is that right?
Yeah, so most of them are, like you said, are European citizens. You know, we have to remember that this attack is coming just... There was a previous high-profile attack in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo attack against
the satirical magazine
and also a Jewish supermarket. Mm-hmm. And that was only in January. And they swept up that cell, but obviously there are still people around capable of doing more attacks. There's a large radical community in Brussels and in France, and these attacks, I think that we can expect more of this because there are more people and more of these radicals around.
And we're seeing some incredible numbers, aren't we? Because people talk, very glibly about, well, now we need to toughen security and make sure the intelligence services are following these radicals. But we're seeing numbers of kind of 5,000 people on the French list of people to follow. And it takes a lot of security agents and spies and police to follow that number.
They have over 1,000 people who they think have come back from fighting in Syria. And then there's the people that they're in contact with that they have to try to keep track of also. And it's a huge job for the security services.
And do we have when security people sort of brief journalists like us, just to follow someone, we say, let's put these people under surveillance. How many spies and sort of secret police does it take to follow one terrorist for round the clock?
I don't know the number.
It's like two dozen.
It's a lot, yeah.
It's an astonishing number. So, Tom, so fairly inevitably, this is now leading to a debate about
one of what had been one of the great political achievements of the construction of Europe in recent decades is the elimination of border controls. You know, you no longer have to show a passport when you drive from France to Belgium. If you're lucky, there's a signpost beside the road with the blue flag of Europe and the 12 stars, and it tells you you've entered Belgium. And that's about the only way of knowing that you've crossed from one country into another. Is that now sort of under real discussion?
Yes, and I hope so, David, for sure. I find it very unsettling. I was in Europe for 3 weeks on a cruise ship lecturing on American politics. And I was in 8 countries. The only passport stamp I have is at the Munich airport when I changed planes to go from Munich to Athens. That's, as far as these governments know, I was never in Montenegro or Italy or Croatia or any of the other places this ship visited. And I find that very disconcerting. Of course, it's convenient, but it is certainly not conducive to great security, to put it mildly.
But Orenderol, I mean, you specialize in security matters and following this stuff. Is this actually an illusion? Could we put up, you know, impermeable barriers between European countries? Or do we have to accept that basically large chunks of Europe are now one big zone, that it's just not possible to reinstall meaningful frontiers?
Well, they're actually already starting to increase the passport checks just between between France and Italy. Trains traveling across Europe in places where they didn't used to check passports are already starting to check them because of these attacks. Europe used to have national borders and a whole system for checking passports at every frontier, and a lot of countries are talking about reinstating that. I don't see why. I mean, right now the issue is that it's very convenient. It's very convenient. It helps the economy of Europe to have a free flow of people and goods, but there could be a great tightening.
And of course, it is true that one large country that I know reasonably well, Britain, still has passport controls. We never joined the so-called Schengen zone, and you have to show a passport to go from France to London on the train and to take a plane.
David, let me ask you a quick question. Since you spent a lot of time in Brussels, what is the deal about this suburb in
Molenbeek? That's a very good question, which I will answer after the short break. So we need to take a short break, and we will be right back with more Issues in the News.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm David Rennie with Oren Durrell and Tom DeFrank. Tom, you raise an interesting question about this one not very large, scruffy, kind of quite poor suburb in Brussels, which really has been at the heart of so many terrorist plots recently. And I think that a lot of attention, and not very friendly attention, is being turned to the fact that Belgium, for various kind of complicated reasons to do with having two different, you know, essentially two different countries glued together, a Dutch-speaking country and a French-speaking country, and they don't much like each other. And then they admitted vast numbers of Moroccan migrant workers because they needed manpower to work in their factories and their steel mills in the post-war era. And they never really got to grips with how to integrate these people or to help them assimilate. There's a tremendous amount of sort of essentially entirely segregated living in these places. And because Belgium is such a dysfunctional country with these multiple layers of government which don't like each other or speak to each other, you're seeing, for example, reports, which is quite true. I used to live in Brussels for 5 years. Many of the policemen who patrol a place like Molenbeek, not only do they not speak Arabic, they don't speak French, which is the second language of these people. They're Flemish police. They speak only Dutch. And so they just ride around armed to the teeth and are totally unaware, really, of what's happening under their noses. And this will clearly put tremendous sort of further strain on Europe. And we're going to see Europe making a bid for sort of geopolitical relevance, Oren Durrell, when François Hollande, the French president, goes on this incredibly sort of symbolic trip this week where he comes to Washington and then goes straight to Moscow. And clearly everyone knows top of the agenda is going to be, is there something realistic that France, America and Russia can all do to fight Islamic State? Because they all three have a big reason to want to fight Islamic State. So they do share a common reason to hate Islamic State. But how could this play out?
I'm laughing because they all want to do something, but they also, there are certain things that they don't want to do. So Francois Hollande is, like you say, he's coming to Washington. He's going to be talking about raising the tempo, shortening the time frame for resolving what's happening in Syria. He wants to talk about the attacks on Islamic State and making defeating the Islamic State much faster. He also wants to talk about the diplomacy for resolving the Syrian civil war, which he wants also to happen much faster. The French are saying that a two-year time span in a war of attrition in Syria to wear down the Islamic State and also to wear down the Assad regime on the other side of the people that they're supporting in Syria is just too long, and that it's going to continue to destabilize Europe and to push more refugees out of Syria and into Europe and to worsen the situation. So they want things to happen a lot faster. And he's going to be bringing this message to Washington and to Moscow. But in some ways, I mean, there are things that they can do. They can, you know, this to attack the Islamic State, to bring them down the way the Americans brought down Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is its predecessor in Iraq. That required a lot of ground troops and a very high tempo of special operations forces working together with local support. Those conditions right now don't exist, and the Western powers are saying that, including France, are saying that they don't want to do that. They don't want to put in a lot of ground troops. The local forces that do exist, some of them are capable, like the Kurds, but they're also limited, and many of the neighboring countries don't get along with each other and don't get along with some of these local actors and don't trust them to represent their interests.
So, Tom, Arun Dural has set out, for, you know, convincingly why there's real limits to what we could do, even if we agreed on what's the best way to fix the Syria crisis. But, of course, the diplomatic political challenge is that France and Russia, or France and America on one side, really, and Russia on the other, they fundamentally disagree, don't they, about whether the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad, this kind of blood-soaked dictatorship, is it a source of fuel for this civil war that makes it worse, or is it, which would be Russia's view, the fire blanket that is, you know, our last best hope of tamping down Islamic radicalism? Is that also?
Well, the U.S. view, President Obama's view, is the latter. He said in recent days that you cannot resolve the Syrian civil war with Assad in power, period. And the Russians disagree. So that is a large fundamental disagreement there, and I don't know exactly how you fix that.
Any sign that the France can bridge that gap between Russia and America, or is France actually closer to the American position in terms of thinking that Assad is part of the problem as opposed to part of the solution?
I think the French agree that Assad is part of the problem. They might be a little bit more tolerant in wanting to get deal with ISIS first and then with Assad later. That is somewhat what the Obama administration has been saying also, that eventually Assad has to go, but they've shifted from saying that he has to go in the beginning of the process of this political transition, and now they're accepting the idea that he can be part of the transition process. And the Russians and Assad's other main ally in the region, Iran, have been a little bit wishy-washy, maybe, about, you know, saying that the Russians have definitely said that Assad could step down, that it's more about, you know, they've been talking more about protecting the state and the security institutions and preventing the state from collapsing, and everybody seems to agree on that. President Rouhani has said that it's not about a man, it's about a regime that they're protecting. The spokesman for Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei said just a day or two ago that they were going to protect Assad no matter what.
So, and you're also saying, if in case you wanted to get too optimistic about Iran as a potential partner for peace, you saw the Supreme Leader putting out statements, or at least put out under his name, suggesting that the entire Paris attacks were a conspiracy by America, that Islamic State is a creation of America designed to divide the Muslim world. So that doesn't sound, on the face of it, like a country that's ready to be a kind of member of a coalition anytime soon.
Right.
Tom, well, we may have to take a break, but let me just start asking you about Russia. So when Russia sort of started sending aircraft into Syria, the prediction in Washington was, well, you just wait. They're going to find that there's going to be blowback. They're going into a quagmire. They're going to get punished for this. Now, nobody in Washington was cheering when the tragedy happened with the Russian airliner full of tourists, which crashed, essentially, we think, a bomb in midair after it took off from a tourist resort in Egypt, Sharm el-Sheikh. But to play bleak, blunt, candid, real politics, is there a sense that that may change Russia's calculations? Are people in this capital here, Washington, waiting to see Russia being more serious about actually focusing its firepower on the Islamic State?
Well, I think that's already begun, David. The Russians have increased their tempo of air attacks against the nominal capital of ISIS, Raqqa, in Syria. But Western intelligence analysts don't believe that there has been much impact in these airstrikes. It's the old air power, if folks say, we can bomb them back to the Stone Age, whether it's Vietnam or whether it's the Balkans or whatever. You need more than that, and I think the Russians are beginning to realize that as well.
So we'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back. I'm David Rennie with Tom DeFrank and Oren Dorel. Oren, you were going to make a point about Russia in
so
Syria.
Part of the issue with these Russian airstrikes is that they're not as precise as what the Americans like to do. And I guess nobody likes to do airstrikes, but they're not as precise as the American airstrikes. And they tend to have a much higher tolerance for the killing of civilians. And the Americans are worried that that will turn the local population against the coalition. So there's debate, I guess, about whether the Russians are a trustable and worthy partner to be in, actually part of this coalition, and that's part of what they're going to be talking about.
And Tom, there's another way, and we're just going to move on to American politics now, but before we sort of weigh into the domestic politics and all the stuff about refugees, which we do need to discuss, the presence of Russia also complicates, does it not, some of the discussion here in Washington of people who are critical of President Obama, who say that he should be doing more. And top of the list, usually for such critics, is to say we should have no-fly zones where we ground Bashar Assad's air force, or we should have safe zones where we declare that there are places that refugees and rebels can gather safely. How much has the presence of Russian air power and now Russian ground forces on the ground complicated those sort of Washington sort of proposals about no-fly zones?
It complicates the situation enormously, David. If you're talking about carving out a no-fly zone, it's one thing to say that we will, we'll shoot down any Syrian aircraft that take to the skies. But suddenly, the skies over Syria are far more heavily trafficked these days because of the Russians, and there have been several high-level meetings between Russian and American military planners just trying to make sure that Russian and American aircraft don't get in the same area and raise the prospects for a horrible in-flight disaster. So it does complicate the whole notion of no-fly zones. Now, safe zones, theoretically, you might be able to create safe zones on the ground. But to do that, as Oren has suggested, you're probably going to need a lot more ground troops, American mostly, but coalition, than President Obama or the American people seem ready to tolerate at the moment.
Now, Oren, let's turn to the frankly unimpressive debate around Syria this week, which sort of bled into this already fairly ugly, populist, noisy presidential election campaign that we're having. And I think we need to divide it into two parts. So there is a loud critique of President Obama, who is accused of weakness and dithering and fecklessness. And the accusation from his critics is that because he is weak, because he has left a vacuum, that is why the world is in a terrible mess. And now we've had speeches from some of the Republican presidential candidates. In fact, some suggestions from Hillary Clinton, the front runner on the Democratic side, that she would handle this differently. So if their accusation is that President Obama has created this mess by being too weak, what are the alternative plans we're hearing? Are we going to see a sort of George W. Bush-style invasion with hundreds of thousands of ground troops? Or what's on the table? What are people suggesting here in America?
So first of all, Hillary Clinton has said that she would do more airstrikes, that she would use, you know, a combination of local ground forces with a lot more U.S. special forces. She's talked about pressuring the Gulf Arab allies and Turkey to stop supporting extremists. Close the border between Turkey and Syria to prevent their citizens from funding some of these extremist groups. She's talked about adding more support to the local friendly militias.
And when Hillary Clinton suggests a no-fly zone, because I think she suggested a no-fly zone, is that a big point of difference with President Obama?
It's a very big point of difference with President Obama. Now, this issue of the no-fly zone, there are people in Washington, such as former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who say the Russians being there, it makes a difference, but that they're doing what they want to do and the Americans should do what they want to do, and that if they have conflicts in the air or if they have conflicts in some way, that the Americans have a much greater capability than the Russians do, and they should call their bluff.
And Tom, let's ask about the Republicans. We've seen Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, some of the Republican presidential hopefuls putting out some fairly specific plans now. What sort of things are we seeing from them?
Well, more ground forces, for one thing, and no-fly zones. And they believe that the administration should be far more muscular. They believe that the whole issue of strength, which is Donald Trump's forte, he's always talking about, I will be a strong leader. Other Republican candidates seem to have gravitated to that as a talking point or a selling point.
But let's be clear. I mean, really, to divide it up into two parts, we're talking about their alternative plans. But beyond the rhetoric, and there is a lot of rhetoric, there's a lot of sort of people in this town saying, you know, we need strong strength and leadership that leads and, you know, just empty talk. When it comes to proposals about admitting Syrian refugees, that's not rhetoric at all. We've actually seen some really serious proposals and actually action in Congress this week.
Yeah, so the House passed a bill that would require the three high-level department heads to sign off on every single Syrian refugee that would come into the country. They want to stop the program and get assurances about security checks. They want much higher level of security. But this is for a program that already has the highest level of security of any refugee program in the United States.
And let's put this in context. So Germany could receive 1.5 million refugees this year. America, to date this year, has taken fewer than 2,000 Syrian refugees. So it's an infinitesimally small number. President Obama is proposing to admit 10,000 Syrians next year. Does it look like that's politically doable, or what have we seen this week, Tom?
Well, it's going to depend whether Democrats in the Senate break with President Obama, because there were enough Democrats in the House of Representatives who voted along with Republicans to get this bill restricting.
Which essentially tells us that the American public wants to pull the drawbridge up and just does not want Syrian refugees.
Exactly right. And President Obama has said he will veto this bill, but if he cannot get enough support from Democrats in the Senate, the votes will be there to override a veto.
And let's actually talk the security implications. Oren Durell, if you were the Islamic State trying to smuggle terrorists into America, would sending them through this refugee channel be the smart way of doing it?
It certainly wouldn't be the quick way of doing it. It takes about 2 years for this process to carry out. What we've seen is just the last few days, there were a group of people who were arrested in Honduras, I believe, Syrians, who are being investigated in any case for some kind of nefarious ties. But this refugee process is, I've been looking into it quite a bit, and it's fairly tight, but it does have some gaps. The FBI has said that there are areas that they cannot verify.
But Tom, the bottom line is if you wanted to get terrorists quickly into this country, you'd choose a French passport holder and put them on a plane, no?
Right, or you'd choose an American passport holder who has been to Europe and has made his way to Syria and is trying to get back in.
So it sounds to me as if we're agreeing that the demands for security from the American people are probably louder and larger than actually what can be realistically delivered.
No question.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week. I'm sure we will come back to this subject again. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Oren Durell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski and John Walker. Our engineer was Jackson Witt and Misha Dubinsky. I'm David Rennie from The Economist. Thanks for listening.